This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Okay, so today I'm going to play you the second half or second part of the Eugene Solidarity Garden, where Anya talks about why these municipalities need to support mutual, whatever you want to call them, mutual aid type things for the community. And this is especially pertinent about because of what went on in the WIT at the Whitaker Neighborhood Council, which I recorded, but it was basically a free-for-all, and I don't want to play it out of context, so I'd have to play the entire thing, and I had to stop listening to it at 8:30, so I have an hour and a half, but I'm not going to play that because, first of all, there's some expletives that really can't be taken out of context, so I don't want to edit those out, but I can't play those on the radio. So that's what that meeting devolved into at the Whitaker Neighborhood Council. And, you know, I was surprised because I've never been to a Whitaker Neighborhood Council meeting, and I was surprised to find that it was kind of conservative. And so what came out of that was that, yes, the Whitaker Neighborhood Council wrote a letter to the authorities saying that they want the permits revoked for giving out food by Breakfast Brigade at Washington Jefferson Park. So then at the end of the meeting, they said, well, the Eugene City Council was going to revoke the permit anyway, so the whole thing is moot. But again, I was surprised that the Whitaker, where it's known for its hippie element and progressive element, that I was surprised that they were against giving out food. And so what the problem they're saying is that the that there's been fights during food giveaways. And, you know, the solution to that is you get some peacekeepers out there to monitor, to de-escalate situations that are going on. So, of course, that would take more volunteers, but that's my solution. And, again, please research all this stuff yourself. And there's some finance that I'm going to talk about. This is not to give you financial advice at all. This is not about, don't use this show to make investments or anything like that. And, again, this is my own observation. No one else is really. No one else is saying this. I see both sides of it in the Whitaker area, although I don't see why you would stop feeding the homeless in the area. But the solution is federal funding for homeless issues. And what I'm saying is I've watched this over 30 years. I've watched this. I'm 62 now, and I've watched our wages have not kept up with costs. And so that's what the issue, that's what's causing all the homeless. And so the solution, in my own opinion, isn't really to build low-cost housing. It's to raise wages so that people can afford to live in a house. And also, the other thing is you shouldn't have to work at slave. You shouldn't have to be a slave to get housing. So we should have housing co-ops. But we don't want a centralized power running things like a socialist situation is. Although I'm not, my thing, I'm progressive. I'm whatever works. Anything but fascism, anything but state-sponsored corporatism, I'm game. I'm willing to listen. So, but my concern is when you have a central power owning all the land and distributing it to people based on need, I'm not sure that that's going to work. Whereas if everyone has a stake in their property, they would tend to maintain it, and it would work much better if people had a little bit of a stake in their ownership. And also the other thing I'm disagreeing with is we don't want, I used to live out at Lorraine Highway. I had 10 acres out there. I was living in a lean-to, and the neighbors, of course, complained. And the city came out there and said, you know, this is America. We don't allow homesteading here. And I went, well, wait a minute. This is America. The whole country has been homesteaded, you know, and stolen from the Indians. And he said, well, we don't want a third world, we don't want cholera and a bunch of third world stuff going on, how I would cause a cholera epidemic on 10 acres, you know, burying my waste on 10 acres. He didn't explain, but I could see what he was saying is that we don't want a bunch of people living in tin sheds with tin roofs. And I'm trying to remember the city in Africa. Is it Soweto in Africa, where they just have a whole hillside of people living in tin shacks? And so we don't want that either. But we don't want, so we want a, and so they're always blaming this on the middle class and homeowners. And so I can see where the Whitaker area would be concerned. And so, again, the solution is to stop spending money. The Poor People's Campaigns, you know, that Martin Luther King said, that I say almost every week, is stop spending so much money on the military. We had, during the Clinton administration, we actually paid off the national debt because there was very few wars going on. And I was surprised that we had, and the Iraq War, in my opinion, is what ruined the economy and caused the 2008 financial crisis, in my own opinion. So I can see in the wit, I can see their point where they don't want to, they shouldn't bear the brunt of the costs for the homeless. There should be federal funding to help the homeless. And the middle class should have a little bit of conspicuous consumption, but not nearly. You shouldn't have to own your own yacht, be able to own your own yacht and things like that. But there could be, you know, even the Native Americans had feathers and beads and stuff that they had some conspicuous consumption. But I'm looking for a classless society where, you know, everybody has housing, education, and health care. So, and I think that's what we're all looking for, but the solution is to get the federal government, in my opinion, to stop spending money on wars. Well, so also at the Eugene City Council, someone got up and said, they were there for, to lower the speed limits in, the city. And I won't name this group, but a lady said, you know, I moved here from New York or wherever, where there was a lot of crime, because it was a small town where I thought there would be less crime. And so we need to do something about the crime. So she's looking for a punitive solution and more police to stop crime. Well, in my own observation, again, it's wages that is the reason we have such a high crime rate, is because we have these corporations that where you're basically a cog in a machine, where you work for these corporations that you have no power whatsoever. And so in my own observation is the rise of corporate America and supply side economics is what has caused the crime rate to increase. And statistically, the crime rate has actually gone down, but again, I can see where this lady wants more police, but that is not the solution. The solution is to raise wages and help people rise economically. And there's always going to be some people that need a safety net from the government. And that's what, even in my own opinion, even under a capitalist system, and I'm not advocating capitalism, but even under a capitalist system, you know, Keynesian economics, when business doesn't do what they're supposed to do, when they screw up and when they don't advance and progress and use new technology, you know, we need to get off oil. And when they don't, that's where government steps in. It's laissez-faire capitalism. That's where government steps in to move when business screws up and can't get their act together and are too greedy, usually because of greed. Okay, so the other thing that's going on is I'm going to play my Venezuela story. And this is another thing that's being, and all these stories to me are taken out of the context, again, of war and the Federal Reserve and U.S. currency manipulation and U.S. Foreign economic policy. Corporate foreign economics policy is where these stories are taken out of context. So I'm going to play you, after the Solidarity Garden, I'm going to play you the Venezuela story that I did, and I'll be doing more of those. And I've just been listening to Michael Hudson, is a great one for this. What just happened is the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are all going to change, get off the petrodollar. So the point I want to make is they're not, what their argument, what I see the mainstream press's argument is going to be is that the reason we need to do this is, for instance, the Theresa May advocated that we seize the assets of the Russian oligarchs. Okay, and the reason, which is exactly what we should have done. But the reason we don't do that is because once you start seizing assets, then no one is going to invest in your currency because they know at any time you could come along and seize their assets. But the United States currency is different because it's a worldwide currency. And so, but the reason these BRICS countries are getting off the petrodollar, and my concern too is that I'm bouncing around, they're going to add Saudi Arabia to the BRICS and other countries that I'm not sure, you know, Saudi Arabia is a theocracy dictatorship that we don't really want to support Saudi Arabia. So, and China too is a fascist dictatorship. We really shouldn't be trading with China or Saudi Arabia at all. So I am a little concerned about the BRICS adding. And so what they're doing is having a separate currency and get off the petrodollar. And the reason they're doing that is not because they're worried that they're going to seize their assets, that the United States is going to seize their assets. The reason is because the petrodollar has been used to for resource extraction and for corporate malfeasance all over the world for literally almost 100 years now, the same way it's been used for flat-out imperialism and colonialism that we call globalization. And again, I've lived through this stuff. I've watched it happen. I was at the Battle of Seattle and at the conference in corporate dominance that happened before the Battle of Seattle. So I'm not an expert on this. I have a degree in sustainable design, but I'm not claiming to be an expert, but I have lived through this and observed things, so I'm giving you my perspective. That's why these countries are trying to get off the petrodollar. And the danger is, though, that the, and so there should be two, that would be great if there was at least two currencies. If one currency was doing something bad, they can move over to the other currency. Unfortunately, again, like I say, it's still a fascist. My concern is they're still using China, who has not been using fascist imperialism, colonialism stuff quite as bad as we have. But if they were ever the only game in town, they certainly would. Okay, so that's what I've got for you today. Like I say, second half of the Solidarity Garden, which needs your support here, and then Venezuela and the sanctions that we use against these countries are to destroy what these authoritarian dictators that have risen to power because of corporations, corporate resource extraction, not because they've been voted in by their populations. So that's what's coming up here. Go check out the open mics if you want to see me, the comedy open mics around town. You'll see me at those. So please support your local comedy open mic. And thanks for listening. Support independent media. Tell your friends.
All right. So wrapping it up, though, on philosophy of what or anything else you want to say, but what about the philosophy of gardening in general and growing your own food? Why do we need to do that? It's not just for yourself. It's for...
Oh, no, it's definitely not just for myself. I'm lucky to be privileged that I could buy groceries, and I do buy groceries. But I think that there's a few things.
I mean, centralized farming,
yeah,
good or bad?
Yes. I mean, I think there's, I think there's, like, in the systems that we live in, we don't have much choice. So, and I'd rather not see my neighbors starve. But I think that I look at it, at what we're doing with the Solidarity Garden as kind of neighborhood defense, as in if people are having a really rough day because they're hungry, sometimes them just knowing that they can get a snack and just being able to have the autonomy to go and forage some food, that I think that's our birthright, is to forage.
Because you don't have a fence around there.
Nope, definitely no fence around there. It's the community's garden. It's not ours. And it's public land. So I think it's like I've seen the power of somebody having having a hypoglycemic sort of moment, having a really bad time. I offer them a plum off of my tree. and they take two bites into the plum and they're feeling better. And so I just think it's like a really easy route to having a more harmonious community is just to like live. It's just like a natural way to live. And I think that, for me, what it creates is, again, that feeling of abundance where we're told that resources are so scarce. And I think it's just because like a lot of those resources have been stripped away by like system, by the systems of control that we live under. And so, gardening, like growing food in general to me feels like, a way to reclaim some of my autonomy. And then also, doing it on public land and opening that garden up to anybody who needs food, not just people who work in the garden, like rejects that kind of like the some of the systems of control that we're living under. And it also resists meritocracy, which I think can be seen as sometimes it's seen as like an alternative to living under like the capitalist hegemon that we're under, but really meritocracy is another route to hierarchy. And
where you're only as free as how much money you have.
Yeah, or as much time as you have to contribute, which is related to money, or at the ability level that you know, physical or mental or emotional ability that you have. So
you shouldn't starve just because you don't have ability or have
exactly,
difficult.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, like living in a community means that we're taking care of each other. And so for us with the Solidarity Garden, it's like, you know, it's so cool when people we don't know are going through, walking through there, enjoying like what they see, enjoying the flowers, and then picking some blueberries. Like it's interesting. I even find myself sometimes having to resist, like having an initial kind of urge to be like, hey, wait, that's our garden. You can't. And then I'm like, wait, no, this is what we're trying to do. That's great. I mean, I don't approach people that way, but it just feels like that's so, can be so trained into us, can be so trained into me, that to feel like I had to be protective over this thing that I did. And it's like, oh, wait, they're just picking berries. They're actually stimulating new growth. And they're taking what they need, and they're feeling empowered to take care of themselves, you know, in the context of, like, a community that's providing these, helping to provide these resources that...
This is how our relationship to plants was for thousands of years, or for millions of years.
Yeah. Jenna, who was the designer who I was working with initially over there, they wrote this beautiful letter to the Solidarity Garden and its gardeners as part of their master's project, and they were talking about like foraging being a birthright, and like systems of government have created these kind of sanitized landscapes to help them evade liability. And we even, like, when we've had like a little bit of a brush up with the county, who like 2/3 of the garden is on county land, they've said, well, oh, this is like kind of a liability for us. And we're like, I mean, it was a bigger liability when it was full of discarded needles and broken glass. So people eating is a liability to you guys. Cause who knows what, it might be poisoned. Like, come on.
When you used to be able to go out in the forest and eat and live,
exactly.
It would be difficult, and there might be some famine or here and there, but you used to be able to do that, and now they've created a society where you can't do that. You have to work.
You can't meet your basic needs unless you're willing to exist, unless you're willing to be dominated by the system.
In modern slavery, wage slavery.
Absolutely. And that's, like, what I think this is just, like, a small demonstration of how, like, using community, we can have abundance, and we also don't have to ask permission to do it. And now, like, those government entities, the city and the county, like, are actually supportive of what we're doing. Not that that's what we were seeking, but, like, but, you know, we've said to them, like, well, this is what we're doing. How are you going to help us? When they've approached us and there was some friction, and their response is like, oh, I guess we'll get a memorandum of understanding together. And hopefully they do that so we can be there longer. But I think, like, if things went sideways for us, we would just start gardening there again. Just keep gardening. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, that's the plan. Nothing's ever perfect. There's every so often there's going to be some sort of drama. I started the tool library up in Friendly years ago. And, you know, you think it's, like, a thing that's just so universally likable that you're doing, that's, like, so helpful, that also shows an alternative way to for us to meet our basic needs through, like, sharing. And, you know, 99% of people are like, this is really cool, I really love this. It's not even, it's an apolitical thing, because we were all taught to share when we were kids. But there's, you know, there's always going to be, like, a little bit of that pushback that you have to figure out how to weather, and you have to decide whether the tactics you're going to take, and it's, you know, dependent on the situation, of course, but, like, the tactics you're going to take, are they going to be trying to push back? Are they going to be trying to work with the, you know, with the hegemon that's pushing against you? You know, like, some... It's just from time to time, it's
watermelon.
What needs done is different, you know.
Well, there's a book called Sustainability and Resistance, and what they're talking about is, like, Chiapas and Cuba, where they're using gardening because they have no resources, and because of the boycott on Cuba, they have no resources, so they just started gardening.
And
that has created a community and fed people. And,
absolutely. And I mean, I think...
Who would have thought that gardening would be a form of resistance?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do think that's what it is. I do think of, like... larger scale. I don't try to, like, promote this garden as that. I just think it's, you know, people think it's a cool thing in the neighborhood, but I do think we are, like, resisting capitalist systems with it. I think we're resisting government systems with it, and you know, like, I think we're resisting, like, an ethos of scarcity, like I've said a million times now, that I think we've been trained into. And I don't think we're going to experience, like, a really catalytic social collapse, like a apocalyptic collapse, like where a bunch of things happen at once and things break down. But we are seeing a lot of breakdown in systems right now. And so I think what we're doing, one of the things we're doing at the Solidarity Garden is modeling, like, what we might all need to be doing more of.
Yeah, these are oases of permaculture, they call it, in some circles, yeah.
Yeah, agroecology, but yeah.
Or whatever, oases of mutual aid.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely like a mutual aid project, and I think, you know, I don't agree with, like, that model of mutual aid, where it's like, oh, we need to build up the systems now to prepare for, like, some sort of government collapse. I think we can have, like, these models here and there, and then people will do what they have to do.
Kind of an evolutionary mutual aid.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people do what they need to do when they need to do it, and
even conservatives are starting to see this, I think.
Oh, definitely.
We're
finding
allies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you wouldn't think you would find them with gardening.
Oh, I think so. I think so. I mean, I think, like, if you listen to one of my favorite anarchist, like, writers and thinkers is, her name's Margaret Kiljoy, and she lives in very rural West Virginia, and she talks a lot about, and she's, like, a very rural West Virginia, very non-passing trans woman, and it's, you know, very conservative place, and her and her neighbors come together for reasons, and, you know, she doesn't try to turn them into Circle A people, but she knows that, like, if there's an emergency, she's going to need to work with her neighbors. And
well, in the food banks, I noticed I'll see anarchists at the food banks, mm-hmm. even the religious food banks. You know. That they serve to anyone.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and I think also, like, there's a I'm no in no way an anarchist historian, and I'm really in a lot of ways a baby anarchist. But there is like a rich history of anarchism in different religious traditions. Obviously, like in Judaism, you think about like the Bund in Poland, in the Warsaw Ghetto, and the Bund resistance. Yeah, so like there's an example of like a religious community that found anarchism. You know, the Catholic workers.
Yeah, the Quakers.
The Quakers, right? So they, I mean, there's yeah. What's the Mennonites? There's like the Mennonite Church has.
Tolstoy said the golden rule, too. If everyone followed the golden rule, we would not need any rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And like some unhoused folks that I've worked with, I've heard more than one person say, like, anarchists are the best Christians I've ever met. You know, even if they're talking about, like, non-religious anarchists. You know, it's just... Because I grew up going to a Unitarian church, but, like, I had a dad who grew up in... My parents both grew up in like communist Poland. My dad grew up in like in the Catholic Church. My mom grew up like the child of a Holocaust survivor. So I grew up in the Unitarian Church, which is like, I would say, has a lot of anti-authoritarian streak in it too, but definitely is not like a Christian church. I would say some people in uni churches see themselves as Christians or Buddhists or Jews or whatever. But I think what I did get from there is, like, a really strong code of ethics, which ended up leading me towards, like, more anti-authoritarian spaces.
Right, to me, it's the Sermon on the Mount is how you sum up Christianity. What he said on the Sermon on the Mount, where, you know, where he served people with a bread and a couple of fishes. He served the whole group and said, turn the other cheek, and that was what... Mm-hmm. How when not the, all of them are into Job, you know, about guilt and faith and stuff like that. It's not about that. It's about serving other people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Serving your community.
Yeah. And I mean, I can't speak to the Christianity side of it or like any biblical references myself, but like, I do think that it's like, I think we're evolution has kind of hardwired us to help our neighbors, because our survival is dependent on their survival, because nobody, you know, no man's an island, I guess.
No, during a disaster, boy, you sure know your neighbors then.
Uh-huh, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, you know, we didn't get, somehow Andrew and I didn't get COVID until this year, but it was during the ice storm, and people were like coming out of the woodwork to help us. And I think that's Sermon on the Mount reference that you're making, like, just really speaks a lot to, like, just our need as a species, like our evolutionary need to, like, cooperate and help each other. And it's, you know, not necessarily about, to me, it's not about service, it is about, like, mutual aid. So
it's in your own best interest to
it is
help your neighbor, because you're going to need them someday.
Exactly. And it's like more enjoyable to do a thing with other people than generally for me than to do it myself. Like,
and really, everyone has something to contribute. You find that a lot of homeless people have a lot of knowledge.
Oh God, yeah,
that
absolutely.
You wouldn't think that they had.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And ingenuity to live on the streets. It takes a lot of ingenuity.
Oh yeah, some of the coolest like building structures I've seen have been people who've been able to stay in one place for a long time and build up structures
out of stuff they've collected.
Cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which doesn't require a job, job for working for the man.
Yeah, no, we shouldn't have to. We absolutely shouldn't have to. It's not what we're hardwired to do. It's like that hierarchy that forces us into that.
All right, Anya of Eugene Solidarity Garden. Anything else you want to say?
News about the recent presidential election and the mass migration into the United States from Venezuela is often taken out of context of U.S. foreign economic policy and International Monetary Fund austerity programs by mainstream media. In a September 1st interview with Federico Fuentes, writer, activist, sociologist, and director of the Center for Studies for Socialist Democracy, Reynaldo Antonio Iturriza López, said, "If we are genuinely interested in understanding what is happening in Venezuela, we need to instead start with what has actually occurred, that is, with indisputable facts. As this was a presidential election, we need to not just focus on the competing political forces, which of course includes the nefarious influence exerted by U.S. imperialism, but above all on the sovereign, that is, the depositary of popular sovereignty, the citizenry." He went on to say, "This sequence of events of material impoverishment, which is always, at the same time, spiritual impoverishment and drastically affects social ties, combined with an imperialist siege that exponentially multiplied material impoverishment and the political impoverishment from ruling out any alternatives for dealing with the situation, all of which was followed by more material impoverishment, helps at least partially explain the very grave fact that a significant part of the citizenry went to the extreme of considering Venezuela's ultra-right as a visible political option." According to Wikipedia, a fall in oil prices in the mid-1980s caused an economic crisis to take hold in Venezuela, and the country had accrued significant levels of debt. Nevertheless, the administration of the left-leaning President Jaime Lucinchi was able to restructure the country's debt repayments and offset an economic crisis, but allow for the continuing of the government's policies of social spending and state-sponsored subsidies. Lucinchi's political party, the Democratic Action, was able to remain in power following the 1988 election of Carlos Andres Perez as president. Perez proposed a major shift in policy by implementing economic reforms recommended by the International Monetary Fund. Measures taken by Perez included privatizing state companies, tax reform, reducing customs duties, and diminishing the role of the state in the economy. He also took measures to decentralize and modernize the Venezuelan political system by the direct election of state governors, who had previously been appointed by the president. The most controversial part of the economic reform package was the reduction of the gasoline subsidies, which had long maintained domestic gasoline prices far beneath international levels and even the production costs. In response to the government's economic reforms and the resulting increase in the price of gasoline and transportation, a wave of protests and riots known as El Caracazo started on the 27th of February 1989 in Guarenas, spreading to Caracas and surrounding towns. The week-long clashes resulted in the deaths of hundreds of people, mostly at the hands of security forces and the military. Hugo Chavez and his Fifth Republic Movement Party won the 1998 elections and initiated the constituent process that resulted in the Venezuelan Constitution of 1999. According to a recent series of articles in the Washington Post by White House economics reporter Jeff Stein, called "The Money War," the Trump White House was warned that harsh sanctions on Venezuela in an attempt to oust authoritarian dictator Nicolas Maduro could accelerate that country's economic collapse and speed an exodus of millions of migrants to neighboring nations, according to three current and former U.S. government officials. Today, however, Maduro remains in power and a surge in Venezuelan immigrants has emerged as a flashpoint in the U.S. presidential election. Though Venezuelan mass migration to the United States only began after President Biden took office, concern among Trump officials about the sanctions' potential effects, including on migration, was more extensive than previously known, according to interviews with more than two dozen current and former U.S. officials. Federal border authorities have encountered more than 800,000 Venezuelans since 2021, although multiple factors, including the effects of the pandemic, have driven Venezuelans to the U.S., their numbers spiked after Biden took office. During a Washington Post podcast, this is how Jeff Stein describes it.
So I've been spending a lot of time recently looking at U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, and there's a huge debate about the extent to which U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, particularly under Trump, starting from 2017 and ramping up through 2020, they were intended on responding to the brutal dictatorial regime of Nicolas Maduro, who was involved in tons of corruption, rounding up political dissidents, regime credibly accused of human rights violations. And under Trump, there was a big movement encouraged by Republicans and Democrats in Congress to really tighten the economic screws to Venezuela in an attempt to encourage their opposition movement. But the way these sanctions worked in practice was they shut Venezuela's government and its biggest source of income, its oil sector, off really from the world economy. And the impact of sanctions to the Venezuelan economy is heavily debated. But if you take some of the estimates as credible, which I do, that sanctions contribute up to as much as a half of the economic impact on Venezuela, you are looking at, in Venezuela, the biggest decline of any economy not at war documented in modern history. And so you saw poverty spike tremendously, tons of instances of malnutrition, people not being able to get food supplies, hyperinflation, tons, you know, more than 7 million Venezuelans have left the country and fled, often to neighboring countries, but increasingly recently to the U.S. The impact on the healthcare system, which was deteriorating because Venezuelans were unable to buy sort of the critical medical goods. I will say, in large part because Maduro and the Venezuelan regime terribly mismanaged the economy of the country, but also because the U.S. sanctions made that a lot harder.
Stein says the unintended consequences of economic sanctions often leave local businessmen without power to fix the economy, giving rise to authoritarian regimes.
A big part of the problem with sanctions is that while the point is to push out the regime or to weaken it, sometimes we find that the elements of a country that are most likely to be able to oppose that regime are themselves counterintuitively and sort of perversely hurt by the sanctions. And so what I mean by that is sanctions will often, for instance, crack down on trade, and often who gets hit by that are legitimate businessmen, a growing, thriving private sector, people who can form a rival power base to the regime. And when that happens, when legitimate private sector trade gets whittled down or weakened, often what happens, this happens in North Korea, in Syria, you see either corrupt actors or the autocratic regime step into that breach.
Ben Norton of Geopolitical Economy Report, an independent research group, quotes from the Jeff Stein series.
Now, what's also interesting is this article notes how the expansion of U.S. sanctions has led to more and more corruption and has in fact created a kind of cottage industry in Washington. It talks about a multi-billion dollar industry that has emerged, including law firms and lobbying shops that have emerged in Washington trying to advise the government and also advise private companies and also lobby for foreign governments to try to lift sanctions or try to figure out how to go around U.S. sanctions. And what has happened is that U.S. sanctions have empowered criminal networks and gangs of smugglers. And this has suffocated the economy of countries like, for instance, Venezuela. This is an incredible fact in this report. The illegal U.S. unilateral sanctions on Venezuela have, quote, contributed to an economic contraction roughly three times as large as that caused by the Great Depression in the United States, end quote. I need to emphasize this fact. This is remarkable. Imagine suffering under the Great Depression in the 1930s in the U.S. with all of the unemployment and the poverty and the hunger. Well, what Venezuela has suffered because of these illegal U.S. sanctions is three times as bad as that. I mean, this is absolutely criminal. Now, what this Washington Post report does not acknowledge is that U.S. sanctions have also killed tens of thousands of Venezuelans. This is according to a report that was published in 2019 by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a think tank in Washington. This scientific paper was published by the prominent economist Mark Weisbrot and Jeffrey Sachs. Mark Weisbrot said, quote, "The sanctions are depriving Venezuelans of life-saving medicines, medical equipment, food, and other essential imports. This is illegal under U.S. and international law and treaties that the U.S. has signed," end quote. And Jeffrey Sachs, a very prominent economist, said, quote, "American sanctions are deliberately aiming to wreck Venezuela's economy and thereby lead to regime change," end quote. They estimated that more than 40,000 Venezuelans died from 2017 to 2018, just in those 2 years, 40,000 deaths. And that is a very conservative estimate, because in 2020, a leading international human rights expert and former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights, Alfred de Zayas, he took it further and estimated that U.S. sanctions on Venezuela had killed more than 100,000 people, according to his estimate. That was in 2020. We're now in 2024. The U.S. sanctions continue trying to suffocate the Venezuelan economy, creating a depression three times worse than the Great Depression. So even 100,000 deaths is probably still a conservative estimate. Again, sanctions are war. They are not an alternative to war. And by the way, civilian suffering because of U.S. sanctions is not just an unwanted side effect. It is the intended impact. The U.S. government has said this very clearly. There is a famous memo from 1960 that was an internal document published by the U.S. State Department, which has been declassified. And in it, the U.S. State Department talks about ways to try to overthrow the new revolutionary leftist government in Cuba after Fidel Castro and Che Guevara overthrew the right-wing U.S.-backed dictator Fulgencio Batista in Cuba in 1959. In this document, the U.S. State Department acknowledged that a majority of Cubans supported Castro and there was no effective political opposition. Therefore, the U.S. State Department concluded, quote, "The only foreseeable means of alienating internal support is through disenchantment and disaffection based on economic dissatisfaction and hardship." And the U.S. State Department insisted that, quote, "Every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba," end quote. And here's the real money quote. The U.S. State Department said that the U.S. government should carry out actions that, quote, "make the greatest inroads in denying money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government," end quote. That is the goal of U.S. sanctions, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government. That's what the State Department admitted back in 1960, and that continues being the U.S. goal in imposing sanctions on so many countries around the world today, especially relatively small countries like Venezuela, like Cuba, like Nicaragua, like Syria.
During a Zoom Q&A at the Eugene Art House showing of the August screening of the 2019 film Gaza Fights for Freedom, Project Censor producer Abby Martin was asked about the Venezuelan elections.
This is a battle of imperialism. You can't look at Palestine in a vacuum without understanding all of the other so-called adversaries of U.S. empire and all of the other countries that are under the boot and in the crosshairs of the United States. And Venezuela has been for 25 years. Why is that? Why is that? Well, they have the largest oil reserves in the world. That's probably first and foremost. It doesn't help that they elected a popular leftist leader on a popular mandate of nationalizing all of their services and providing a big mobilization for poor and working class Venezuelans when Hugo Chavez got elected. So we've seen, oh God, how many coup attempts now? Six? It's a bipartisan pulse that transcends administrations and politicians. And that's how foreign policy works. And so what you just saw, and again, I think a lot of people are confused, rightly so, because the media lies. AP, I just saw AP, CNN, BBC, Guardian. I mean, it doesn't matter what, you know, side of the political spectrum, liberal or conservative, it's all the same. Maduro's an autocrat. He's a tyrant. He committed fraud. He's a dictator. He killed all the protesters. That was a funny one. You know, I went to Venezuela in 2017. It was the height of the deadliest protests in Venezuela. And I embedded myself in the riots and I risked my life because I honestly was victim to the propaganda as well. I went there wanting to learn with my own eyes. I thought I believed some of it. Because I just didn't know better. And I think a lot of well-intentioned people do fall prey to propaganda because they don't know. Why would we know anything about Venezuela? How would you know anything about Venezuela? So I beg people, instead of thinking that you know something about Venezuela, remind yourself that the same media that has been lying about Palestine 10 months is also lying about Venezuela. And, you know, they have elections every 6 years. And their elections were heralded by Jimmy Carter back 20 years ago as some of the most rigorous, transparent, robust elections in the entire world. They have hundreds of international observers that observe these elections every time because they know week in advance the opposition is going to declare fraud and they're going to decry to Israel and the United States and beg for U.S. intervention. And that's exactly what happened. There's no proof presented and the corporate media just goes along with it. And I'll just leave you with one thought. Of course, there's a political diversity. Of course, it's not a monoculture. Not everyone's Chavismo and not everyone's a socialist. No one claims that. That's why Maduro barely eked by. He won 51% of the vote. That's not a mandate. People are suffering. 7 million Venezuelans have left. The economy was in free fall for years. There's real suffering, real hardships. The problem is that the opposition tries to erase the millions of Bolivarian revolutionaries and Chavismos and Venezuelans who support this project. They try to erase them and they want to privatize the oil. That's what came out from Gonzalez's platform, the opposition candidate who's backed by the US. Their first plan of action, privatize the oil and gas, privatize all the housing. So yes, there's political diversity. The Communist Party split recently. There's 10 other political parties, but really the opposition that's backed by the US is far right. And they got 44% of the vote. And they were begging Israel to actually invade Venezuela back in 2019. Maria, I forget her last name. She's the head of the party. She wasn't the presidential candidate, but she's the head of the party. And she was literally, they fly Israeli flags. Because this is, again, it's like there's not only an international anti-imperialist movement that's very pro-Palestine and Maduro. You know, he's wearing a keffiyeh when he voted and he said free Palestine. You know, it's not just that. It's also Zionism. When you're looking at the international reactionaries, that globalized, very, very strong core of the right wing who are very mobilized. Zionism's very core, part and parcel with that. That's why you see Bolsonaritos or whatever the Bolsonaros fans waving Israeli flags too, because it's become a rallying cry for fascists. So yeah, I think all you need to know really is what the opposition stands for. And that's, you know, it really is revealed, I think, with begging Israel to invade.
If the media reported elections of authoritarian governments in the context of world finance, voters in the U.S. might urge leaders to use more humanitarian efforts such as debt forgiveness and social justice measures instead of the costly turmoil caused by austerity, globalization, and corporate resource extraction. Above all, they might leave citizens of emerging nations to control their own destiny with true democracy. Reynaldo Antonio Iturriza Lopez put it this way: faced with a confusing situation resembling a political labyrinth with no visible way out, I believe it is time for self-restraint and strong character. Actions motivated only by moral indignation will invariably lead to false steps. I am convinced new situations will arise. As I said, order reigns in Venezuela and with it calm. But it is an anxious calm. The Venezuelan people will have the last word. For KPW News, I'm DJ Susti.
saying some alarming things by someone who works for breakfast per day. We were called some alarming things. Alarming things. Alarming things. Some alarming things. Invited Lisa Levinson to this meeting tonight. Is she here? That says a lot right there. We invited her to please come to the table and talk with us. Let's find a way. So yes, did we write a letter to the city council? We did. So yes, did we write a letter to the city council? We did.
I obviously am a solution-oriented person, obviously. I've been doing this a while, and I wanted things to be better. Neighbors expressed the concerns of the Whitaker Community Council were about the amounts of crime and sex trafficking that had increased in the park and the increase of garbage in the park and surrounding areas. We are aware that there was a marked increase because of the amount of people in the park since the recent sweeps on the railroad. Completely aware. In collaboration with the Whitaker Community Council, we tried to find a solution multiple times to help move either move food around to more hungry people or to release some pressure from the Whitaker, such as going mobile. We had offered multiple ideas, choosing different locations on different days, also keeping a day in Washington Jefferson always. And we still do burritos on the weekends. So just to clarify with people that think that the Whitaker Community Council is against food in the park. In collaboration with the Whitaker Community Council, we approached with the compromises and solutions. The breakfast crew was not willing to adjust their service schedule or any adaptations. The permit to feed at Washington Jefferson Park was lost due to non-compliance with the city, which was in motion already the day before this letter from Margaret went out. This happened with my knowledge after I was informed. Due to the other concerns, along with the permit revocation, the Burrito Brigade Board voted on Sunday for our contract to end the Breakfast Brigade because of the liability issues. The decision to pull our support from the Breakfast Crew goes everything against Burrito Brigade and myself personally stand for. This has been a very hard week. We were hopeful that a solution could be reached and we will continue our efforts to feed people and remove barriers to access, but we can't do it when everything is made more difficult. But we can't do it when everything is made more difficult. can't do it when everything is made more difficult.